Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the If I Had One Wish podcast. I'm Crystal Hicks, and today my co-host is Sarah Schofield. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Go on, tell the listeners a little bit about who you are.
No problem. I'm Sarah. I'm Director of Customers and Communities at ADRA Housing Association in North Wales. I'm also a board member for Community Housing Cymru, which is the sector body in Wales, similar to NatFed in England. And I'm a board member for Wish North Wales.
Lovely. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks so much for joining us and being my co-host today. So today's guest is Aileen Evans. Aileen is a well-known and respected leader across the social housing sector. She recently retired from her role as Group Chief Executive of Grand Union Housing, where she served on the executive team for over a decade. Many know Aileen for her work for the Chartered Institute of Housing, where she was president in 2020 and now sits as vice chair of the board. Aileen has said that she came to campaigning later than she would have liked, but boy, has she made an impact. She is a passionate advocate for justice, and in her own words, she just became really gobby. Welcome, Aileen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm really chuffed to be asked, actually. It's a real privilege to do this sort of stuff. So thank you for having me. My mother always said you've got to say thank you for having me. So thank you for having me.
You're really welcome. Sarah's going to start us off with our questions today.
Yeah, Aileen, can you tell us a bit about your career? How did you end up in housing and what has made you stay?
Staying actually was the easiest thing once I got here. So I wanted to be a professional musician originally, but when I was playing the French horn, there weren't that many women horn players in orchestras, and getting good music school places when you were a woman was actually really quite, well, bloody difficult. And I didn't want to teach because I didn't think I had the patience to teach. I think patience came to me late, like a little bit like campaigning, actually. Patience and campaigning came late. Patience came when I had children. So I went to do a job for a year at Nottingham City Council as a housing trainee and fell in love. And from there on was hooked. And I wasn't ever going to do anything else. And if I had have known, you know, picking up on Ellie Holt's campaign about Choose Housing, if I'd have known it was there for me to choose, I would have chosen it first off. Because Arthur Oscroft was the director there then, and he was really, really a really passionate CIH person, but also really keen on training young people. And they had four trainees a year in the housing department. We were all required to do our CIH, but I had a really varied traineeship in technical services, in housing action areas and general improvement areas. Anybody remember those? We need that back now, actually. And allocations, lettings, slum clearance. That's what they used to call regeneration. Mm-hmm. In the old days, it was slum clearance. And actually from there, it was about people. And I think we overcomplicate housing. And I've always thought we've overcomplicated it because we get hung up on IT and treasury management. And all of those things are important. But actually, it's about people and the homes that enable them to have good lives. And if we completely fixate on that, actually we won't go far wrong. So yes, it was just about people. It was about people whose homes we were knocking down, where their families had grown up, and you know, they'd got a brook at the bottom of the garden that the kids had played in, or they remember scrumping apples off the trees. They're the sorts of thing. That's what home means. And so kind of I got hooked really quite young and stayed there ever since, because it's been very absorbing and different, and it's been a real privilege, because I think not everybody does a job where you can work with people to provide the tools for a good life, and that's what a home is. It's a tool for a good life.
Yeah, It's interesting that you mentioned about the traineeships and the apprenticeships, because obviously going to university is a very expensive business these days, and that opportunity for people to get access into the housing associations and work in different departments, I think that's a really excellent start for your career, isn't it? Where you can see what the various roles are and sort of find your place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, well, and find your place and then re-find it when you go somewhere else and move around and stuff. It's very, yeah, it's a good grounding. And that's why at Grand Union, you know, we were very clear about having apprentices and trainees, and also very clear about supporting CIH qualifications, because I think that was, it was really, really important to me that we had people who knew what they were doing, who could prove that they knew what they were doing, frankly. And that's what a good qualification does.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like you had a really strong foundation there, Aileen, quite early on that you could springboard from for the rest of your career. And, you know, you have progressed to become one of the sector's best female leaders.
Oh, that's kind.
Well, it's true. But, you know, you did that at a time, maybe had different barriers to what we had to today, or maybe the same barriers. I don't know. I'm keen to know. Did you experience maybe barriers that your male counterparts were experiencing when you were coming up? How did you overcome those?
Yeah, when I was reflecting while I was thinking about this, and when I first joined Nottingham City Council, everybody above middle manager, and I mean everybody above middle manager, was a white man, mainly middle-aged, sometimes older. So, and I think one of the things, and I'm a mum of girls, I'm a mum of twin girls, and I think it's really important for people to be able to see what they can be. So I guess a barrier was that at the age of 20-something, when I went into the housing department, I couldn't see what I could be. And that however subliminally, gives you a message that management and leadership isn't for you, because it's about being a man, and white, actually, about being a white man. So that was a kind of a barrier, because there was nothing to aspire to, because I was never going to be Arthur or Peter or Malcolm, because I wasn't a white man. That was a barrier, that creates a barrier in you. And it was only when I found out who I was really that, and started doing it on purpose, to quote Dolly Parton, one of my all-time favourite heroes, that I realised that actually defining yourself by what you can see sometimes is something that you do to yourself, and actually something that with some support and help and a bit of work on yourself, you can undo. So there was that. So I couldn't see what I could be. And then there was all the stuff around, you know, when I was doing major improvement schemes, estate improvement schemes, we would sit in site huts with builders and site supervisors who were all men, with page 3 girls and nude calendars all over the walls. Now, you don't see that now. You know, the most offensive thing in our office a few years ago was we had somebody in IT who was mad on Kylie Minogue. Well, you know, a Kylie Minogue calendar is a world of difference for what we were confronted with on a daily basis. And actually, then that's another message, isn't it? Because it tells you how women are seen and should be seen by the men who do the work. I didn't get a job once because a chap got it that I had to work for. He was useless. Everybody knew he was useless. I'm not naming any names here. And there were useless women as well as useless men. It's not, you know, I'm not typifying men here. And I didn't get that job. But then I worked for this chap and effectively did the job for him until I stopped. And then everybody noticed, and then they got rid of him. It was a bit like that. And I think women have to move around more. I think what I saw was men more likely to be promoted from within. And that if you wanted to get on, which I did, then I had to move. And I moved actually to a tiny local authority with a brilliant male boss who said, well, you can do that. And I said, well, they had a whole team of people to write the HIP strategy at Nottingham City Council. He said, well, we haven't got a team here. It's you. And actually, you've got to do all these other things as well. But you have a go. And I'll support you. there's been really good male allies before the term male ally was a thing. There's been really good ones of those in my life as well. But I think it was about, it wasn't expected that you were going to be a manager, because nobody, no other woman was a manager. And it wasn't, and because women were the things to look at and be pinned upon the wall.
I was going to ask, Aileen, when you've mentioned male allies, and that's what was going through my mind when you were talking, that there are incredible male allies as well, aren't there? And that you certainly are at ADRA, where I work, the chief executive, the directors, and right through the organisation, I think you do see that there are real male allies and the importance of that.
Absolutely.
Expectation and culture that they set makes a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And it was that I had no belief in myself when I left Nottingham, no real belief. I was qualified, I knew what I was doing, I could relate to people, but I didn't really have an awful lot of self-belief. And when I went to work at North East Derbyshire with Bill Best, Bill is the chap, and we're still in touch today. He did a reading at my wedding. He just saw what I could do or what my potential was. And that's such that, you know, North East Derbyshire was very politically one-sided. It was a very, very, very strong Labour council with a very quite dominant hierarchy of mainly male councillors, it has to be said, a few women, but mainly men. And they would say to me, well, you go and talk to David Aileen, you go and talk to the leader of the council, because he'll listen to you, he'll have a chat with you. And that was actually because I was learning how to be myself and doing it on purpose. And so then you grew other male allies out of that. And I learned from people. So yeah, no, there are some fantastic, and I've had some real great male allies in my life, and I've been a good female ally to some men who have had some issues and or been struggling or needed some confidence, or, you know, I'm particularly interested in supporting women into leadership positions, but there's some really capable men who, you know, could do with a bit of support from time to time too. So, you know, I try and be there where I see it. For me, it's about potential. For me, it's about potential. And there are so many women with potential who don't get the opportunity to realise it. And that's why Wish is great. And that's why, you know, all the other stuff that Donald Trump appears to be dismantling. Absolutely. Just, you know, and we miss out. We are poorer for not being diverse and not hearing all the voices. We make poorer decisions.
Do you think what's happening in America will have an impact in the UK as well?
I hope it doesn't, because I hope we've got a level of maturity. I'm an eternal optimist, you see, and I believe that things go in phases and the world goes in phases. And we're in a bit of a shit phase at the minute. You know, it ain't great, is it? It's a bit, you know, I've deleted the BBC News app from my phone, because although I think I ought to know it, I really don't want to.
Yes.
Because it's not good for my mental health, and my mental health is really quite precious. And so I would hope it doesn't. And I would hope that there are enough people in Parliament, outside of Parliament, in institutions, running organisations, you know, people like Polly Neat, who's about to step down from Shelter, people like Kate Henderson, people like Fiona McGregor at the Regulator. I would hope that there's enough women and people of colour and people arguing for greater neurodiversity and all of that. I would hope that there's a head of steam that means that we don't kowtow to that sort of idiotic nonsense, because it's just deeply, deeply damaging. Frankly, we should be better.
Aileen, you touched there on mental health, and sometimes we have to be so proactive, don't we, in making positive decisions to protect our mental health in a world where information and news is just constant, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were president of the Chartered Institute of Housing, you had the opportunity to do a campaign to get gobby. And you campaigned on mental health awareness through the Shine a Light campaign. For anybody who doesn't know about the campaign and what you sought to achieve there, could you just talk about that a little bit and the legacy you think it's had?
Yeah, well, I hope it has had a legacy. So I, like many of us do, but didn't talk about and still don't, have personal stories around mental health. My husband had poor mental health. My father had poor mental health. you know, my Uncle Ivan ended his life. We've all got those stories and nobody talks about them. And I could see in our teams in Grand Union that they're what the consequence of customers' poor mental health and the behaviour that led to meant for the mental health of the people who were around me. And so it kind of started with a bit of a question about, well, what is it we can do? How is it we can equip people? I hate the word resilience, because resilience to me says, well, just pick yourself up and sort yourself out, really. But I think, what tools can we, both practical tools, both all sorts of things that help support people when they need it, given that the job of housing teams is more around mental health now than it has ever been. See, in some of the stuff that happens is the consequence of poor mental health. So it started with a bit of a question about how could we do that. And then I thought, well, actually, if my lot are, if that's what's true in my organisation, it will be true in other organisations. And nobody's talking about it. And I felt that I had a story to tell. What I wanted to do was for people to look and think, well, if it's okay for her to talk about it and she's a chief exec, then it's okay for me to do that. Because it's that seeing what you can be again. So I spoke to CIH when I was elected vice president. I said, this is what I wanted to do. We worked with the brilliant people at Mind. Mind were absolutely wonderful. Begged, stole and borrowed bits of money and people's time. And we produced two guides for the housing sector, a specifically tailored mental health support guide for colleagues in housing that recognised that what they were seeing every day was the consequence of poor mental health amongst their customers, and gave some tools for organisations to implement that. We then did a very simple guide around communicating with customers, communicating with tenants, and that was about simplifying communications. It was about being quite direct. It was about clarity, really, in communication. And we started on a whole programme then of flipping thousands of letters housing associations send, far too many in my view, but we simplified the language in those, and we really simplified our communications. We were much more direct. And there's a lovely story actually from one of my colleagues, and this was actually quite recent, and I'll get back to the campaign bit in a minute, but it kind of showed a bit of the legacy of the campaign. I was in the office, I don't know, just not long before I left, and somebody was stuffing envelopes, and I said, what are you doing stuffing envelopes? Because don't Neopost or whoever it is did our post, you know, the system generated a letter and a computer somewhere stuck it in an envelope. And she said, well, it was one of our debt advisors. She said, I've told our tenant to look for the flower on the back of the envelope because I really need them to open this communication. And they don't open any letters. So I've said to them, they've got to open this one. It's from me. They don't need to worry about it and to look for the flower on the back of the envelope. So when we think about engaging with people in a way that gets them to help themselves, it's about how we change to facilitate that. And that was kind of, in a sentence, that was kind of what that campaign was about. So how can we be the flower on the back of the envelope for one another, really, I guess? And then, so getting back to the campaign, we did those two guides. The guide for communicating with customers did not have the flower on the back of the envelope story. That was completely the invention of one of my brilliant colleagues. But it got people to think about that. And then the wonderful Professor Joe Richardson did a really in-depth study around young people and people working in housing that looked at mental health and what needed, again, to be true in organisations for young people in particular. And actually some really surprising stuff came out of that about younger people needed a better career view. They needed to see where they could go. And the other thing, that we were in the pandemic by that time and we were all working really hard thinking that we were doing the right thing, but there was a real disconnect with what chief execs were doing and saying and thinking and what people on the ground were feeling. And so that helped us a bit, I think, at Grand Union in particular. And I hope it helped others, because it was a really, really good bit of work and still relevant today. So the legacy was those three pieces of work. But I would hope that, you know, the woman in the Northeast who contacted me to say, oh God, when you talked about menopause brain and losing confidence and not being able to drive, that resonated with me. And I thought I'd better go to the doctor. And he tested my blood and he says, I'm in the menopause. And it didn't occur to me that that's what it was. So there's little and big and medium stuff. And I hope it's had a legacy because it was, because me, it came from my experience, my husband standing on a railway station platform when the twins were five saying, I don't know whether to get on this train or jump in front of it. You know, that and my dad attempting suicide when I was 16. And we've all got these stories because one in four of us at any one time has a challenge with our mental health. I just really wanted to talk about it so other people would start talking about it. And that's why I did it, really. And the fact that we did it in a pandemic, we didn't know there was going to be a pandemic. No. You know, serendipity,
perfect.
Really.
Perfect timing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Aileen. I think I picked up there about what you were saying around resilience and how it's not a great word, is it? Because I think sometimes when we talk about mental health, we think we just need to get tougher. And there is a bit of, like, you know, having some agency and being able to control what's happening around you. But that, I don't know where it comes from, but that quote always sticks with me, where someone said, we need to stop creating organisations that people need to be resilient from. Like, we need to stop being employers where our employees need to be resilient because we're rubbish, and our tenants need to be resilient because we're rubbish.
Absolutely.
We need to get better and not just say that the default is you just need to be more resilient. Yeah,
it's tosh, really. So
and that actually
I think in terms of, you know, and encouraging people to be honest and open about their feelings. Do you know what? People know when you're having a bad day because they can see it on your face. And so if somebody says, are you okay? And you said, oh yes, I'm fine. People know you're telling fibs. So naming it is really, really important because it gives them permission to come and tell you. When we moved offices, my office was in the corner and it was glass. And I had it deliberately made out of glass because I was accountable and people needed to be able to see. And the door was always open anyway. And somebody came in one day and said, can I just come in here and I need a hug? This was an assistant money advisor. Because they're talking about Putin nuking the world out there and I can't listen to it anymore and I'm having a panic attack. So I stopped what I was doing and we had a hug and I said, is there anything else you need? And she said, yeah, can I have a cup of hot chocolate? So we got her, because she needed sugar, we got her a cup of hot chocolate. Do you know, it was only sometime afterwards, I thought, Christ, the fact that she felt able to do that is really humbling. It's really, really humbling because, you know, by some means, we'd created an organisation where people felt able to ask for what they needed.
Amazing.
And that's the stuff where people don't need resilience because they know they'll get support and they know that they can ask for it. And that's the resilient bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think that with what you hear quite often from, I think people who go into housing by their nature, that it's like a family, isn't it, of very empathetic, caring people who are drawn to this role and want to support tenants and make a difference to their lives. And a phrase that you often hear is left holding the baby, with the impact of austerity, with other agencies have not got the funding that they need. Services like the police and the NHS don't have the staff and services and capacity to meet that increased demand. And then there's a huge impact on the housing officers who are dealing with cases where they really need the police to do a welfare call, or, you know, they really need support of a mental health worker. So the role of housing is, by because of that austerity, sort of is changing, isn't it, it probably always has been an element of that, but it's far less on the technical aspects of the job, isn't it, and much more pastoral and supportive and lots of checking and just trying the best, I think, to help people.
I think you need both. I think you need the technical capability because, you know, things like, God help us, Grenfell happen when you haven't got the technical capability. Yeah. But I come back to the point about it's about people and it's about understanding people and it's about, and you're dead right, in, you know, in the context of the rowing back of the state, housing teams are the last people standing. And so they're dealing with an ever more complicated set of issues. And we had, I had long debates with our board about where do we stop? Where, because we can't do all of it. Where on earth do we stop? And part of the reason, you know, Grand Union went into a merger with Longhurst to form Amplius. A primary reason that we did that was because some of that stuff that was really, really, really precious, we were going to have to stop doing. And nobody wanted to do that. And that wasn't what any of us came into this job to do. So you're dead right. So frontline colleagues at Grand Union and now at Amplius get clinical supervision if they want it. Yeah. They get the opportunity to have specialist support and counselling. We've swapped people out of jobs where they've been in high stress roles and they've gone and done something else for a bit and then they've come back and all of that sort of stuff. It's about seeing the person. And we talk about seeing our customers and seeing the person there. We need to do the same with colleagues too if we're to get it right, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, Aileen. That's been really insightful. So what's next for you?
Well, so actually I'm working with Crystal at the Church Housing Association, hopefully soon to be registered, yes, everything crossed. And I feel really useful, actually, and it's great. And I feel as though I can add some real value and a bit of non-exec work. But actually, you know, my best friend in the whole wide world has a life-limiting illness and keeps telling me, Aileen, I won't be around to make old bones, so I had a 2-day spa break with her and she lives in Minehead. So I'm going to see her at Easter. So I'm going to be spending much more time with Pat, Pat taught my kids to swear. We didn't swear when the kids were little. We do a bit more now. So I'm looking forward to having time with her. My children will be 18 next year, both are thinking about university and what's next for them. So actually this time with them is really precious. Yeah. And valuable. They've just started driving. Imogen got into second gear yesterday. And, you know, being able to share all of that and not thinking, oh, I've got this to do and I've got... And the sheer stress, actually, of running a housing association over the last few years when we've had post-Brexit, cost of living crisis, pandemic, getting continual quartz out of pint pots. You know, it's... I'm quite not checking social media to see if somebody is complaining about their auntie's boiler because I want to fix those things.
Yeah.
And I'm not worried about that. It's wonderful. And actually that has, and I'm reading books and going for walks. Actually, generally, I did always go for walks. I didn't read so many books. Walking is my mental health safety valve. So I'm having a life really that's, and my husband, when he hasn't worked since the twins were 5, and he's run around supporting me. And actually, it's a bit nice to be able to give some stuff back because he's lovely and he has moved heaven and earth so that I could do what I loved. And actually, he's gone back to university now to do a degree in contemporary music. So I'm supporting that. So that's what's next. It's stuff I like with people I like, absorbing interesting work where I felt good and useful, I hope.
Brilliant, brilliant. Some well-earned balance, it sounds like. Yes, definitely. Aileen, we are drawing to the end of our podcast. I think we could talk for hours, couldn't we? But alas, we do not have hours. What I do need to ask you before you go is the question that this podcast is known for, which is that if you had one wish for the sector, what would it be and why?
So I thought again long and hard about that because my one wish for the planet is that everybody has a safe and secure place to call home. But actually for the sector, it's about taking the opportunities that the last difficult years have and are continuing to present for us and providing properly tailored services that help build trust in landlords. I think that's where we is really properly understanding our customers and rebuilding that trust with them. And we'll only do that if we understand who people are, what they need. We move away from sheet dip housing policy that says, computer says this. We tailor an intervention. We work with people to help that most precious thing, which is a home, be a proper springboard for life, and we can only do that if people trust us with that.
Amen to that. Aileen, it's been fantastic to have you on the podcast today. I really enjoyed that. And Sarah, thank you for being my co-host. You've been listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast.
Thank you everyone for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector who will be sharing her career story and what she's learned along the way. And of course, we'll be asking again the big question. If she had one wish, what would it be and why? See you next time.